This is an MPB Think Radio podcast.
Hello, I'm Dr. Nancy Lottridge-Anderson, president of New Perspectives, a fee-only financial advising firm and co-host of Money Talks. For over 10 years, Money Talks has been answering your personal financial questions and sharing knowledge about money management. Money Talks can be heard Tuesdays at 9 a.m. on MPB Think Radio. Podcasts can be found on our website, money.mpbonline.org, or on your smart device's podcasting platform.
Well, good morning. It's Monday morning. It is Deep South Dining, and we're right here on MPB Think Radio. Good morning, Carol. How in the world are you?
Malcolm, I'm great. How are you? How are you, Malcolm?
I'm good. Your hat fell off.
I know. I have an issue. How can you wear a Kentucky Derby hat over headphones?
Yeah, I can't figure it out. I had mine on. It fell off. And for our listeners, just so you know, we are getting in the Kentucky Derby spirit. Mona Nicholas, the executive director of the International Ballet Competition, is going to be with us a little later in the show, but she brought hats for the entire MPB Think Radio staff.
Yes, and we look so fine.
We're looking very snappy.
My hat is a pale blue with lots of ruffles, and it's very large.
It's a fine hat.
It is.
Yeah.
Makes me want to just jump on a plane and go to Louisville. May 4th.
On May the 4th. More about that later. Meanwhile, what was your week like? You know, you and I were actually together over some of this past week in another town.
We were indeed. We were both at lunch on Thursday at Grit in Oxford.
In Taylor.
At Plain Air. Mm-hmm. Yes, at Plain Air. And Malcolm, I don't know about you, but I think their food is fabulous.
Yeah, I really liked the food. I ate there twice while we were there. We stayed out at Taylor at Plein Air, and we had both the luncheon that you and I attended, where I had lamb chops and polenta and some vegetables, and we had a great salad, a little gem salad. The food was great.
I know, and I had the most wonderful piece of grouper that was just
encrusted.
Encrusted grouper. It was so finely dressed, but that has gotten to be one of my favorite places in that area.
And we actually went back that night after the Bill Dunlap opening at Southside on the square in Oxford. We went into town for the opening and then came back out to Plein Air and had dinner at Grit. So I had a lunch and a dinner at Grit. The food was delicious. Now, I attended the conference on the front porch this past year, which is organized by Campbell McCool and the good folks at Plein Air. And Grit, they prepared all the food for that conference, and it was delish, and I knew I had to come back. Also, while I was in Oxford for the Bill Dunlap opening at Southside, we had dinner at St. Leo, which is a fantastic restaurant in Oxford. We had two dishes that really blew our mind. One was a shrimp and spinach. It was a sauteed spinach with these grilled jumbo Gulf shrimp, which was just magnificent. That was Carrot's favorite dish. Then we had a grouper. Speaking of grouper, there must have been an abundance of grouper in Oxford this weekend. Somebody caught a big one. But we had grouper. She's losing her hat again. We had grouper on a bed what was it? Was it rice? I can't even remember now, but it had shaved asparagus and sweet peas. No, it was couscous. It was on a bed of couscous with shaved asparagus and sweet peas. Just delicious. Now, you guys ate at...
We ate at Snack Bar.
Snack Bar, yes.
And, you know, my favorite dish of the night was a butter bean. It was a hummus or a puree. And it had, you know, the Moroccan douka on top. And it was delicious. Didn't get to check in with Chef Vishbot. I think he was off that night. Yeah. but his staff served him well, and it made me run back home and get out my cookbook, I Am From Here.
Oh, so this week,
Chef Vish.
It's going to be a Vish week.
It's going to be Vish week.
Now, I will brag on a dish that Kara made last night for dinner. We had a pasta with some homemade marinara, but the entree was a cauliflower that was seared in a skillet and topped with a wonderful sauce she made. And I know sort of the fillet of cauliflower or the cauliflower steak has become a real thing. But we were happy to have it in our home last night, and it was delish.
Well, I just want to say something nice about you, Malcolm.
What's that?
I was really pleased that you went all out for Kara's birthday.
Well, of course. That's what one does.
Not everybody does that, but I thought that trip to Oxford and you wined and dined her in the way that she deserved.
Well, she certainly does. And we had a big fundraising event Saturday night for the Canopy School, and we had a huge event over at the school raising money for them, and she was very happy to get that done. They raised a lot of money for the school, and it was a fun event. So we had a great week. I mean, we were in 2 days in Oxford / Taylor / Plein Air and back in Jackson before that big event. So it was a great week. Now, Kara, we got a couple emails this past week I want to touch on. I love it when people call, of course, and or email. We love hearing from people who are listeners. And also, we love hearing from people who listen, who stop us at the grocery store or at the dry cleaners or in line at a restaurant and tell us that they listen to the show. It means a lot, and we appreciate it. So we got an email from Walter who said, "Surprised that I did not hear anything about Easter baskets when you were talking about your Easter foods. In our Ukrainian tradition, we fill a basket with foods meant to be symbolic, and we take them to church for blessings. Each of us takes a small sample of the blessed food, and then we go on to the bigger meal of similar but not blessed foods. It is not just for Sundays, but daily until the blessed food is gone." So, Walter, that's really nice. Thank you for sharing that. We did not include Easter baskets, but Now we have. And Carol,
next
I think
year.
There was another email as well.
I have one from Stephen. This is really interesting. Listening to Deep South Dining as I was driving to church Easter morning, I was reminded of an hors d'oeuvre that was common around Easter time in my childhood. And those were Easter lilies. These were made using square white sandwich bread with the crust cut off, spread with either butter or mayonnaise, and one spear of canned white asparagus was placed on the bread diagonally, then wrapped in a trumpet shape so that the yellow asparagus looked like the stigma of a lily.
Oh, the lilies.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
And he said, "My grandmother would flatten out the bread with a rolling pin so that it would stay in shape without a toothpick. This was the only time she would use bought mayonnaise.
Otherwise,
as it is whiter than her homemade." This was considered fancy food in rural Australia in the 1970s.
Wow.
I saw these at a funeral reception a few years ago and was shocked at how good it was. Definitely in the don't knock it till you've tried it category. I love the show. Y'all are providing a great service in highlighting our regional food culture. I can't wait to listen each week to learn something new. Thank you, Stephen. That's
very nice.
Really nice. And I've never heard of this Easter lily.
Now we know. There's no excuse. We got to get on board here.
Australian thing.
It's a beautiful thing.
Okay, Malcolm, I have a couple of things from Cooking and Coping, our Facebook page.
Yes, please report out.
So interesting, but last week we had the folks from the Dirty Napkin Supper Club on. What a trip.
Yeah.
But, yeah, the idea of supper clubs, there's so many different takes on supper clubs, which I didn't realize until last week. But one of our top contributors, Lisa Wardlaw Smith, posted something about her supper club this weekend, and they all cooked from Susan Spicer's Crescent City Cooking. So everybody cooked something out of the cookbook, and I think that's a great idea.
Fabulous.
And it just made me think that we should do a show or a call-in on various supper club themes, because I thought that was one that needed to be shared.
That's a good one, and we appreciate Lisa sharing that with us.
Yeah.
Did I have the name right?
Yeah.
So, you know, growing up, a supper club to me, well, first of all, there were no supper clubs in my childhood, so let me correct that.
Would this
As I got older, in
Parkinson?
There were no supper clubs. As I got older, I knew that supper clubs were when a group of friends got together and everyone brought a dish or prepared a dish. And that was, I was in a supper club in Jackson in the early 80s and 90s. And then I've learned since that supper club can be a theme of a gathering for the public, like the one with dirty napkins that we attended. So, and maybe there are more interpretations or definitions, but those are the two that come to mind for me.
Yeah, but I think this public supper club is a new thing. I mean, I think it's a relatively new thing that, you know, the first one I had seen around here was David Raines in Flora.
Mm-hmm.
You know, has the supper club. And when I was in the Delta supper club was just starting. And, man, is that a big deal.
Is that bricks and mortar or is that a moving feast?
No, it is a moving
feast. A movable
feast. It goes from, I remember in Greenwood, it was at the airplane hangar. They bring in, you know, a well-known chef. Mm-hmm. And the tickets are, you know, rare.
Hard to get.
Hard to get. But I love the idea. So let's do more work on supper clubs.
Absolutely. Great topic. And one that fits perfectly right here on Deep South Dining. We're going to welcome Mona Nicholas to the show. Mona, as you know, runs our fantastic International Ballet Competition, our Mississippi/IBC. Or is it backwards?
It's the USA IBC. It's the official competition for the United States.
Thank you for clarifying that. But Mona will join us. And we will also have a conversation about the difference between butter beans and lima beans. Our great friend April McGregor will join
us. From Philly, Pennsylvania,
will join us on the phone. And she has started a conversation on cooking and coping, and we want to contribute. So we're going to have April come on. We thank you for joining us this morning on Deep South Dining. Malcolm White, Carol Palmer, happy to have you this morning. Now we want to welcome a great friend to the show, a listener, a poster on cooking and coping.
A texter during the middle of the show.
And a tap dancer.
Yes, and an accordion player.
And she is a former member of a supper club, which we're going to find out about here. Welcome Mona Nicholas to the show. Good morning, Mona.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
When she's not tapping and using all her other talents, she is the executive director of the USA International Ballet Competition. And, you know, why not Jackson? We have been the home of the competition for
over 40 years. As a matter of fact, our next competition in 2027, we will be celebrating our golden anniversary. So
good gracious.
50 years of artistic excellence.
Fantastic.
Yeah, and it's just such a wonderful thing that Jackson has this event. And it's a great story of how a former dancer and teacher Thalia Mara came to Jackson to head up Ballet Mississippi.
Well, to start a professional company, because the local arts-minded citizens thought Jackson needed a professional ballet company. So they went in search of somebody that could help that, and that's where they found Thalia Mara. And they talked her into coming. And she started the company, and she noticed that the studios emptied out on Friday nights. And she couldn't figure out why. Well, they were all going to the football game. And so that's when she knew that people from Jackson loved a competition, which led her to bring the International Ballet Competition to Jackson.
And at that time, the major competitions were Moscow, Varna, Bulgaria, and Helsinki, Finland. Was there?
Helsinki hadn't come along yet, but there was one in Tokyo at the time, which fizzled out. But once she started us, then Helsinki came on board. We're the third oldest international competition in the world.
And there was a declaration in Congress that made it so.
Right. We're designated by the U.S. Congress as the official international competition for the United States.
But I love it that she connected football.
Of course she did.
And ballet.
She's a smart woman.
Malcolm, I know you were at the first one, and I had just moved to Jackson at that time. But I can just remember that Newsweek magazine wrote an article about the ballet competition being in Jackson, and they said whoops and yep, rebel yells accompanied any time a dancer would leap into theirs. Yeehaw! Let's woo! But now we have a very sophisticated audience that's right. Built over the years.
We've been trained.
We've been trained.
You're probably wondering what the International Ballet Competition story has to do with Deep South Dining, and it has the following to do with it, Carol.
The Friends of the USA IBC are having their annual Kentucky Derby party on May 4th, and you and I love to talk about the Kentucky Derby every year, so this seemed like a great opportunity to see what is really going on, since the Derby, yes, it is a horse race.
It's a competition.
Uh-huh. It is a competition. There are hats, but Derby food is special and legendary and so much fun to talk about. Derby food and drink.
Yes. So the actual event will be Saturday, May 4th at the Kennington Mansion in Belhaven. And it is the 2024 Kentucky Derby Party, sponsored by the Friends of the International Ballet Competition.
Right. The Friends of the International Ballet Competition are very important because they are our volunteer group and also fundraisers. They are the major benefactors of our outreach program named City Dance. And that program has been in existence for over 20 years. And it's very important because we provide free ballet lessons to children from Jackson Public Schools. And we provide them with dancewear and shoes. They do not have to pay 1 cent.
That's terrific.
That is terrific.
So let's talk about the party and the food and drink. So will the Jackson-based celebration feature traditional Kentucky Derby foods?
Absolutely. Well, first I just want to preface this, that this is not store-bought food. This is food that is made by our members of the Friends. So it is really wonderful. We have some great cooks, and they sit down and come up with the menu. And we do have some traditional Derby food. We'll have a big salmon with capers and Benedictine spread.
Now talk about the Benedictine spread. That's a certain type of...
Have you ever had a cucumber sandwich?
Yes.
And it has that delicious cream cheese, cucumbery spread. And this spread was invented by a lady named Jeannie Benedict. And she's the author of the Red Ribbon Cookbook. And she lives in Kentucky. And how you make it is you put cucumbers in a food processor. Now, back in the early 1900s when she invented this, she was chopping and all that. But now you can put it in the food processor, and you strain it to get all the seeds out with some cheesecloth, and you add the cream cheese in. And it can either be spread on bread or served with a salmon or used as a dip, a dip, and it's delicious and refreshing.
So you're going to have two versions of that at this party. Is that right? It says two recipes here.
Well, that means a double recipe.
Oh, times two.
Double recipe. So,
but you will be serving the Benedictine spread.
Yes.
The aforementioned. Also, dates with goat cheese and almonds. Our great friend
Ivy Alley will be preparing. Ivy, hello to you. And she listens. She's a
told
supporter.
Me how to make it, and it just sounds delicious. And she is a great cook, and she came up with that recipe all on her own, so it's an original.
Oh.
Okay, my favorite are, well, bourbon balls and derby pie. So, talk to us about the bourbon balls. Will there be bourbon balls, and will there be many?
There will be many bourbon balls. You couldn't have a derby party without the bourbon balls. What I love about the history of this story is it was two women that were school teachers, and this is like early 1900s, and they were not making enough money to support their families. And of course, you know, they survived two wars, a depression, and they were able to survive because of their bourbon balls. They started out because it was during Prohibition and the bars had closed down, they were able to have their candy making business in a closed down bar. And rumor got out that they were lacing them with some liquor. So that helped sales. They were very ingenious marketers. They were known to have even gone to the movie theater, and they would talk loudly about how great those bourbon balls were.
And hey, it's the original guerrilla marketing, Malcolm.
Well, that or they were half crocked on bourbon.
So the ladies' names were Rebecca Gooch and Rebecca Hanley Bowie.
Ah, and the Rebeccas.
She's known as the mother of the bourbon balls. So they opened a business called Rebecca Ruth's, which I think is still in existence. So if you ever go to Kentucky, make sure you go there because it's supposedly the best.
Now you've got deviled eggs with phyllo cups.
So instead of dealing with the white part, we'll have the deviled egg mixture in a phyllo cup.
Is that traditional, or is that just something y'all came up with?
That's just something Southern.
Okay.
Well, country ham biscuits are another, you know, great Derby tradition. You know, and they use the great hams from
the country
up there.
Hams.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
that we like so much. But the derby pie is my favorite, and I have been to many derbies. I have the hats to prove it, and the foods just, you know, blow my mind.
So do they have, like, tailgate set up at the race, or is the food vended by professionals at the –
They're both.
Okay.
But also the restaurants, when you go to parties, there are lots of events around the derby. You know, big events for the 2 or 3 days,
and leading up to
food at the Derby.
Okay,
you can get a bourbon ball. You can
at the race.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
And you can get Derby pie
at the racetrack.
And Derby pie has both pecans and loaded with chocolate chips. And I looked it up; it is 700 calories a slice.
Mm, good.
So you know what's in it.
Pecans tend to do that.
And chocolate. But I was hoping to track down our friend Rebecca Wiggs, who's from Kentucky. And every time we talk about Derby pie, she calls in to tell us.
She knows
she
a thing
it.
Or two about the Derby.
Yes,
and the food and beverages.
But
there, so.
You know, the last thing I know we need to touch on, we cannot forget get the mint julep.
Oh, it's the star of the party.
Yeah.
For
and
sure.
Do you, either of you have a recipe, or do you just kind of go from what you've learned?
We rely on our friend Melvin, who is, you know, he manages the bar for us. But the key, of course, is mint. But you have to have a special kind of ice.
Yeah,
crushed ice.
Yeah.
And so we have to go to Sonic or to Chick-fil-A or somewhere we know that has it and buy bags and bags and bags of it because you really can't have it. And, of course, you've got to have a mint julep glass.
Right.
We have lots of those. We used to drive to Batesville to rent them because we need hundreds of them.
Mm.
And but they're delicious. And we've done everything from actually try to convert a recipe into making large volumes of mint juleps that tended to be very messy. And then they made a pre-mixed Kind Makers mm-hmm. Mark makes that, but we can't get that anymore. So Leslie at Briarwood has come up with a way for us to make it with using some bitters, and I'm sure Melvin will, you know, have his take on it.
Well, yeah, the key to the mint julep is the muddling.
The muddling.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You must muddle the mint.
The mint. Muddling the bottom, the mint.
Yes, in the bottom of the glass with a muddler. And
please describe for Radio Land what a muddler is and how you muddle.
A muddler is a tool that looks like,
imagine a pharmacist crushing some pills.
Oh yeah, yeah, like
mortar
a pestle.
And a pestle.
It's a mm-hmm. like a wooden pestle that mm-hmm. you muddle, and you also, you know, muddle mojitos, so it has
and
many
that,
uses.
That releases the
essence.
The essence
of the
mint.
Mint.
Yeah. And then it must be topped with fresh mint.
As a garnish.
Yes.
But let's before we get there, we muddle at the bottom.
Muddle.
Then ice.
Then ice, simple syrup, and bourbon.
And what, do you know how many ounces, what glass size that is?
It's a highball glass.
Six to eight ounces. Something like that.
And is it one shot of bourbon, or is it two shot
well,
and a half?
Well, that depends on the person. But
And do either of you have a favorite bourbon that you put in a mint julep?
Well, this year we're using Four Roses.
Okay.
But Maker's Mark, I know that Evans Williams makes some premixed.
Ezra Williams.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Carol, do you have a favorite?
I'm kind of a Maker's Mark.
Maker's Mark.
Or a Jack Daniels.
Oh, okay.
A premium Jack Daniels.
Okay. But Kentucky, of course, is known for bourbons.
That's
so
yeah.
Lots of
Woodford Reserve.
Woodford Reserve.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
And at a lot of these derby parties, they will, you know, have one manufacturer's bourbon mm-hmm. for the mint julep. But I'm going to be making derby pie and mint juleps.
For your own self.
Just for my very own self and mm-hmm. family.
But for everyone listening, please know that you are invited to this soiree.
It's going to be wonderful. We have the Accumulators Bluegrass Band playing. Mm-hmm. We actually watch the race on several televisions. At the event. We're serious about it.
Very serious.
We're very serious about it. We have some games that you can play that you can root for your favorite horse.
This is not just a fake. I mean, some people just have a Kentucky Derby party with that. I mean, this is the real deal.
This is the real deal. This is the real deal.
And we just got a text that says, how does one get tickets?
There you go.
You can get your tickets at the door, or you can go to our website at usaibc.com/friends. If you just go to the homepage and scroll down, it's right there, too. You can press on the link.
Or you can just put in your search engine, USAIBC, get to the website, and you'll figure it out.
But plenty of tickets available.
Plenty
Everyone's
of tickets
invited.
Available, and it's well worth it, and you're supporting a good cause. And we have a great price for young professionals, 21 to 35 years old. We want you there, so you get a half-price ticket.
So you pick a horse. There's no placing a wager because that's illegal, but part of the party is you pick a horse from a jar or
right.
You get a number.
You get a
so
number.
So you have a horse to promote, unless you come with your own, of course.
Right. You actually can win. It's a horse raffle, basically.
Horse raffle. Okay.
So you can pick your number, and if your number wins, you win the raffle.
What about a hat contest? Do you have a contest for the best hat?
Best hat and best dress, male mm-hmm. and female. So, and you're not required to dress up. We've had people in linen shorts or blue jean shorts and a linen top, but it is fun to dress up and wear a great hat because you could possibly win a great prize.
And Malcolm, you could win because you've got the shoes, the clothes. I mean,
love linen.
The
linen.
Yep.
All right, so that is Saturday, May 4th. From 4:30 to 7 p.m. At the Kiddington Mansion in Belhaven.
That's on 1020 Carlisle Street, right near the grocery store.
Yeah, so everybody's invited. So be there or be square. We're going to get into a very serious conversation about the difference between butter beans and lima beans.
It's serious.
Very serious. It has blown up the internet on cooking and coping. Our great friend April McGregor will join us to have this conversation. Mona will stick around. She's also a former farmer and a foodie, and she's a big-time listener and contributor to our cooking and coping site, so she'll have lots of insight. Thank you for joining us on another episode of Deep South Dining right here on MPB Think Radio. Malcolm White, Carol Palmer, and our special guest, Mona Nicholas, is with us from the USA IBC, Mississippi, I guess. I always want to put Mississippi in there.
Well, that's important.
It is. It is for me.
The economic impact that that generates for Mississippi is $48 million last summer.
So nothing to sneeze
at. You have to say Mississippi.
Nothing to sneeze at. Carol, we were scrolling about on cooking and coping, and we sort of reintroduced ourselves to a topic that our great friend April McGregor posed, and it got you and I going this morning.
It did, and it was some research she was doing, but it popped back up around this morning as the first post on cooking and coping. And we've been missing April, even though she lives in Philly, PA. Right. She's a Mississippi native, a sweet potato farmer. Her family are sweet potato farmers. And though she's lived and worked in North Carolina and now Pennsylvania, we claim her. And good morning, April, and thank you for jumping in with us.
Good morning, Carol and Malcolm. I'm so happy to be speaking with you both. I have not been on the show, talked to you all, and I don't know, has it been a year? It feels like it's been a while.
It's been too long, and we have spotted...
Maybe that's summer, last
yeah,
summer.
Well, we have spotted photographs of you on Facebook in Mississippi, and you have not been to see us, so...
So we're calling you out.
Yeah.
You know... It is true. My family keeps my schedule pretty packed, so I'm always thinking I'll have more time to dally about, and it never comes to pass. So I'm headed down there for Memorial Day weekend for my nephew's graduation from Starkville High School. So I'll be around soon.
Maybe maybe you can come to the studio, or... If you don't come see us, we may come see you with the microphone. But April, your post about lima beans and butter beans resurfaced, and you know there were 90-something comments, maybe 100 comments of people. So tell us why you were doing this research, and then let's dig into it.
Absolutely. So. In September, I actually participated in a lima bean dinner. Chef Valerie Irwin from here in Philadelphia and I were guest chefs with we partnered with a farm here in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, who did a lima bean grow out for the USDA. They are working on lima beans as a crop that is very resilient to climate change and droughts and things like that. And we're trying particularly to look at what types of lima beans do really well in this area of southeastern Pennsylvania and that people also really like. So we're trying to find that sweet spot of the ones that do well in the climate and that are kind of universally loved. Now, because of, so I posed the question as like, you know, what's the difference between lima beans and butter beans and what do people in different areas call them? Because I was trying to prove what I thought I was encountering, which was in the Northeast, people tend to think of butter beans as the big, fat, mushy, sort of institutional associated ones, whereas just the opposite seems to be mostly true in the South, outside of sometimes people do call the small green ones baby lima beans. I think I did a pretty good job of proving that. It seems to fall along regional lines what people call a lima bean or a butter bean.
I was shocked at all of the different, I mean, I couldn't find a thread or a theme in there. I got so confused. But when I saw it, when I was reading the post this morning, I was thinking, Malcolm has got to
he's
see,
a bean
see
head.
This.
He's a beanhead.
Why start us off with box
it, my response to that post, which I did not respond at the time, but I was reading over it this morning because Carol brought it to my attention, is that growing up, the green ones, the little green ones for us were butter beans, and certainly the speckle ones were not only butter beans, but they were the beloved speckle butter beans, which I think of them as a prized bean. The white ones, particularly the large ones, we call limas, and my grandmother on the white side of our family cooked them. Made a dish, a regular Sunday night dinner was a bowl of the big white lima beans, which we called boxcar limas. But it was lima beans and ham, chunks of ham, cornbread, and a wet salad. That was a Sunday dinner in the rotation at my grandmother at C.T. Pat White's house.
That sounds like some good pot liquor.
It's the best.
And is that your family that's like around, I think, Boonville or like the Northeast?
No.
Is that family or a different family?
We grew up in Stone County down in South Mississippi. I did live in Northeast Mississippi through my high school and beginning of college years, 65 to about 72. Hal and I and Brad and our family actually grew up in Stone County in Perkingston. And those relatives all lived in Wiggins.
Oh, yeah, I know Wiggins. Okay, great. I know exactly where you are.
So why we call that in that part of the world, we call the big white ones boxcars, the green ones butter beans, lima beans. But there are so many varieties.
And April, so I had never heard of boxcars until I knew Malcolm, and it's like on the show when we talk about what we were cooking over the weekend, Malcolm will say, I did a big pot of boxcars this weekend.
That's
so
great.
I wanted you to know that.
Yes, I'm so glad. I'm gonna see if I can figure see if I see that been referred to as that anywhere else. If there's a lot of times it's like it could have been a label that they were, grown under, a seed label. It could have been a brand. It could have been they were associated somehow with a railroad.
Right.
I have no idea.
Who knows?
Are they big like a bot or kind of shaped?
Gigantic.
Yeah. Or it could just be a nickname. Exactly. That's exactly how I refer to butter beans and limas, although we definitely ate a white beans and salad kind of meal a lot, but it was never lima beans in those. Lima beans, those big fat ones, were something other people ate for us. We did not really eat those. I may have encountered them, at a cafeteria somewhere, but I never, intentionally ate those. But I did as an adult, like once I was living in North Carolina and like visiting or South Carolina, that style of exactly the dish that you're talking about is often served with rice in and around Charleston. You see it in all the like North Charleston sort of soul food restaurants. That lima beans and ham is a very common dish.
But that was the only one of these beans that was an entree. In our childhood, the other beans were all side items, But another bean that fascinates me because it fascinated my brother Hal is the navy bean. And when Hal and I spent summers in D.C. working as pages, Hal for Jamie Whitten, myself for Senator Stennis, we became enamored with the navy bean soup they served in the cafeteria in the Senate office building. And we got copies of the United States Congressional cookbooks for
for our friends. When we would come home from D.C., we would bring home. And Hal began making the navy bean soup, which was a legendary soup in that part of the world. But it was really the first soup that Hal and I sort of got focused on was this, you know, those little white navy bean soup.
Oh, yeah. Those are the beans that we had of white beans. My mom would always, navy beans were our sort of white bean of choice. We had those far more than we had, like, red beans and rice. Those were our main, like, beans and ham hocks that we would cook.
Right.
Whether it was with cabbage and corn, usually with cabbage and cornbread, something along those lines.
Well, I want to go back. I grew up in a green butter bean family.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. Looking at 100 posts and seeing all the mm-hmm. different interpretations of what people think is what people call a butter bean, what people call a lima bean, I'm interested in hearing more of your regional mm-hmm. take on it. If there is such a thing, I couldn't
yeah.
find it.
No. So absolutely. So one of the things that I found is, I mean, most people, if your family grew, if they grew butter beans, if they grew, you know, whether you want to call them, you know, we should probably just refer to them by their Latin name, but I'm talking about either or. The names lima or butter beans are mostly colloquialisms, regional terms for the same thing, although there are certainly different varieties and they have different colors and textures and flavors and certainly size, and that is, you know, to be taken into consideration. But most people in the Southeast, in particular, if your family grew anything, they called it a butter bean. It is by far most prevalent that they would call it either a speckled butter bean or, you know, a green butter bean or a baby butter bean or whatever. But once we started buying those little green ones in particular from the store, they are mostly grown and sold out of Delaware. They're the largest producer of baby limas.
You heard it here.
Usually called, because that is how they're labeled. Pick Sweet calls them baby limas. You know, the different Bird's Eye calls them baby limas. And they're those little green butter beans. And they're quite good. And we recognize them as something that tasted very similar to the green butter beans that, you know, whatever, our families grew. And that influenced us, I think, referring to the green ones in particular as baby limas, because that's exactly how they're written on the packaging. Up here in the Northeast, what I find is that mostly people call everything limas, but the prized ones here, especially you will see this a lot in Jersey and Delaware and the areas where, I mean, despite what we see in the media, a lot of Jersey is actually agricultural. There's tons of farms and tons of produce coming out of Jersey, and same with Delaware. And we all know the Eastern Shore of Maryland is also a great big agricultural area. Well, the prized bean there is the pole lima. So it is a lima bean that, you know, grows instead of a bush lima growing close to the ground. It grows on trellises and, you know, poles and things that people build for it to run up and down. And those are their prized homegrown beans. They are too fussy to have adapted to industrial growing because it cannot be machine picked and all those types of things. But that is the type of bean that people grow at home, and they have a similar beloved, rich, tender flavor the same way that our butter beans, whether they're green butter beans or the speckled butter beans, we always think of the speckled butter beans as being that kind of richer, meatier, little starchier butter bean. The green.
That's true. A little starchier. That's a good mm-hmm. description.
Yeah.
Well, I can say from growing up on a farm and having to actually shell these peas and beans, my favorite were the larger, because you could shell them a lot quicker. My mother used to say, you can have this, you can go out and, you know, be with your friends, but you have to shell this entire grocery bag full of beans. So I got to where I could, like, shell a bean, throw one away. Shell a bean, throw two away. So I can finish faster. But did y'all know that there's a song by Loretta Lynn called, and it used to be one of my favorite songs, and my, or my friend and I used to sing it to us, but life is like a bowl of butter beans.
Can you hum a few bars?
Life is like a bowl of butter beans. That's
wow. Well, that's I didn't. I'm not familiar with that.
Well, we need Java.
DJ Java, where are you when we need you?
I'm more familiar with a song that the Carolina Chocolate Drops popularized. It's an old tune called Cornbread and Butter Beans. Do you know that one?
I don't,
but I do love the Carolina Chocolate Drops.
It goes, can I sing a bar?
Yes, please.
Do I get a chance? Okay, here I go. Let's see. Cornbread and butter beans and you across the table, eating beans and making love as long as I am able, hoeing corn and cotton too until the day is over, we'll drive a mule like a crazy fool in love again all over.
I love it.
That's great.
April. April.
Oh, we knew we loved you for so many reasons, and now we have more.
April, I was in Oxford over the weekend and had a wonderful butter bean puree at a restaurant at Snack Bar that I went to. And the first time I saw that recipe was in Frank Stitt's cookbook, I guess 10 or so years ago. And I was wondering if you have made a butter bean pate.
Well, we, so one of the really exciting things that I absolutely love doing, and this is the kind of cooking that I love the most, is going very deep on a single ingredient. So for our lima bean dinner, we made all sorts of things out of lima beans. We definitely made lima bean dip, sort of like a hummus, but I would imagine that's very similar to like a pate sort of thing that you're talking about. And speaking of... all the different things, yes, absolutely, that you can do with beans. We use bean flours. We used dried lima beans and ground those into flours that we use to make little pancakes and crepes and things like savory ones that you would serve, you know, with chutneys and things of that sort. We actually did a chicken dish, a braised chicken dish with tomato gravy that instead of serving it with rice or mashed potatoes, we actually served it with one of these white lima beans, the big ones that we're talking about, puree. And it was just revelational to people where, you know, you're used to, it reads like mashed potatoes, but, you know, it's silky and delicious and all those things that we often kind of complain about those big lima beans, about them being mushy or soft.
They April, I wish you could see Malcolm's face. Really, I wish you could look. His eyebrows are just like pointed up. Is a Malcolm White meal.
So what I'm thinking about is how you get these dried limas. How do you make this
the flour
out of? How do you dry the limas to get the flour?
So we literally, you could just leave them hanging on the vines. We did that some until they dry. You know, in certain years, you know, especially in the Southeast, we just don't have the perfect climate for drying things because some years we get these fall rains. But still, people definitely dried a lot of things on the vine. The other thing that you do is you just buy lima beans dried already in a bag, and you can grind those.
I see.
In so we use different things.
I see.
We tried a coffee grinder, a blender made for, you know, one of the high end kind of blenders that can handle that sort of thing. And you can get pretty, I even successfully ground them in a food processor, but then you have to sift it out and keep, you know, grinding the stuff that doesn't get so small. But yes, just a coffee grinder actually works really well if you don't need to make a huge batch.
I was sort of envisioning putting them in a sock and hitting them with a mallet or something. I don't know.
Well,
I think we'd like for her to make this for us.
It sounds
you
great.
Definitely can. One of the great ways for doing it is so we were on the pancake side of crepe side of things. we were taking from Indian cooking. They have a pancake made with normally a type of dal, a split pea or lentil, in part like rice flour. Those are called uttapams, is the little pancake version. And then there's a crispy crepe version. And right now, of course, since I'm on the radio, I'm blanking on the name of it, but I'm sure you all probably know it as well. But it's a very crispy, unbelievably delicious crispy pancake or crepe sort of thing that you roll around a filling that is often like potatoes and mustard seeds and things like that, and it's served with a lot of delicious chutneys. So and a great way to avoid having to make flour is that to make those things, you actually soak the beans overnight, or you can soak rice overnight, and then you do sort of a wet grind where you get the pancake batter, the crepe batter that way, as opposed to having to start with a very dry batter.
All right, April, we got to fly. We thank you so much for joining us this morning. Deep South Dining is a production of Mississippi Public Broadcasting's Think Radio.
This is an MPB Think Radio podcast. To hear previous shows, visit mpbonline.org or download the MPB Public Radio app to listen on your iPhone or Android phone on demand.